All right, it's Escape from Plan A for this week. It's Teen. I've got two people I haven't talked to in a while. Jess is here. Jess, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Yeah, I've been away for a little while, but a bit happy to be back. Just life.
Nice. And in even longer, it's Trevor from Champagne Sharks, man. T, how's it going?
I'm pretty good. How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. You know, it's just like, you know, we talk a lot through chats and stuff. We haven't done a pod in a while. And I know we were meaning to, and then, you know, Justin and I were just kicking around some thoughts I don't know, has been sort of like preoccupying my mind ever since I went on this binge of like 90s era movies and maybe like late 80s. And I don't know if you guys ever do this, T, I don't know if you do this, but like watch movies from like when I was maybe like a little bit too young, or maybe too young to really understand the context of like an adult rom-com or something like that. You know, like we were just talking about Frankie and Johnny, which I think is like 1991. And I watched Moonstruck too, which is like really sort of like 87, I think. I totally would not have understood that movie if I watched it at its time. But it gives me sort of like a sort of clue as to like what was actually going on back then. I don't know if you know what I mean.
No, I know. 10 in the late 80s?
Yeah, like 9, 10 years old. I would have made no sense out of that movie. But
Sure. Yeah, I got the Frankie and Johnny Wikipedia because I'm pretty sure most people listening are just not going to, they're also not going to know.
Truly it's a terrible movie.
Funny. It's kind of funny. It's Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer. So
zero
like,
chemistry.
They came off of Scarface to do this, though.
Yeah.
They were in Scarface.
Oh, I forgot they were in Scarface together. You're right.
Yeah. So to go from then, you're like zero chemistry. It's a Gary Marshall.
No chemistry in Scarface either.
Well, I guess that was kind of the point of that movie, right? She's coked out of her mind and
And she's kind of disgusted by him, but she's just with him for like the money and he's like kind of lecherous. The lack of chemistry works there.
Okay, yeah. That's actually kind of a hilarious casting. I got to see it just to see that. The only one that comes to mind is there was this gritty movie released in the mid-aughts with Cate Blanchett and what's his name, Hugo Weaving. So they're coming off of playing like the elf king and queen of like Middle Earth to playing like washed up junkies in Sydney, Australia. It's a really good movie, actually. It's called Little Fish. Oh, wait, no. I think so. But it's hilarious just to watch them be complete losers after coming off of Lord of the Rings.
All right, so I never heard of that, but so this is what I was getting at is, okay, so I watched Moonstruck, which is 87, and I think there's this big gap between what was going on, very broadly speaking, I think there's a big gap between what's going on in the 80s and what's going on in the 90s, and if you watch something like Moonstruck, it's like it still has elements of like older, like Hollywood storytelling. It's that guy Jewison who did like Fiddler on the Roof and stuff like that. So he's, you know, he dates back to like the 60s and 70s. And it's about like, you know, this Italian family. They're like really embedded into like Brooklyn. There's like an extended family. It's a family drama. You know what I mean? And then you go to like 91 and it's this very 90s. There's something very 90s about Frankie and Johnny, which is like these two sort of like people who basically like are either completely estranged from their family or just don't seem to have any family at all. And Pacino plays like an ex-con and Michelle Pfeiffer's sort of kind of like a runaway from her family. Not a runaway in the sense of like a runaway teenager, but she's like trying to escape her sort of like family situation at home with her like, you know, with her mother and stuff. And they both are just sort of like refugees in Manhattan. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but like they go to work for this diner, and the diner has a sort of like ersatz family quality to it. Like everybody is, you know, there's like a sassy waitress and everyone sort of, and then there's like, you know, there's like a Hispanic line cook and there's like a black dude who's like the waiter, the black dude eventually has a script optioned in Hollywood, and they have like this big going away party for him, and that's sort of like the sort of like dramatic centerpiece of the setting of the film. And it just reminded me a little bit of something like Rent or something, you know, where it's just like these people, random assortment of like characters in the city who like form this family. And that's sort of like this, it just doesn't happen in real life, but I just feel like that's a very 90s thing. And I was immediately thinking of like Rent. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
It does strike me as a 90s thing. I feel like setting it in the city, maybe. But I mean, I feel like there's a lot of movies and plays and books where people are kind of in like what I call a way station. Like they're in a moment in their lives where they're all passing through different directions. And it might be set like in a building or a hotel. Or even like something like Casablanca, like, you know, just like people who are kind of all passing through, not like in a literal way, like we're passing through for the night, but, you know, this could be where we are now. Like, you know, I'm just moved to the big city to be an actress. And like Laverne and Shirley, I think, is kind of what I think with TV series, though, makes it tough because the TV series has to last for years as opposed to a movie. So they'll just kind of all be in the building for like years. It's something like Friends, maybe. Things where like normally this would be a year of everybody's life, you know, and then somebody would move on somewhere else. Somebody would get married. Someone would whatever. But I do know what you mean.
Yeah, it's like that, but it became perpetual. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's necessarily 90s. I feel like the 90s is when it peaked in America, because like you bring up Rent, but Rent is a musical version of like a much older opera, La Boheme,
yeah,
by Puccini, which was in like I think he wrote in like the late 1800s. So that's kind of, you know, it's about like a starving waitress and her artist slash revolutionary friends who get drunk all the time in Paris. So it's kind of like what where France was like 100 or 200 years prior to where we were. So it's really, it's a story about like post-industrialization.
You get your own cabaret too with Berlin. I think that has a similar vibe.
Yeah.
Or people passing.
Yeah. Passing so like in between La Boheme and Rent would be like cabaret or something.
Yeah, but like if you look at 90s sitcoms, like a lot of, one of the things I noticed about 90s sitcoms versus 80s is suddenly like the family just disappears. And the 80s were like so family centered. It was like the era of child stars. Like you had to have, you basically started with the children, and then the parents were almost, it almost seemed like they were sometimes cast after the fact from the kids. But the point is centered around this family. And by the time you get to the 90s, like a lot of the big time, not all of them, of course, but there's a real shift towards, I think, like couples without children or just a group of friends.
Yeah.
I feel you know like what the bridge sitcom is then between that what you're talking about in the 80s or the 90s? That's 30 something. Do you remember that show?
I do. Yeah. I never watched it, but
yeah,
I do remember
it. Yeah. I think that one was like a dramedy. Well, they should have built it as a time because it was still kind of like a drama too, right? It wasn't a full-fledged sitcom, 30 something, right? Am I remembering correctly?
It was like, was it an hour long multi-camera show, right? Or a single camera, I think.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like,
I thought it was an hour long.
It's yuppies. That's where I believe the term yuppie really took off. And then, but they're kind of in that bridge. So they're cast a little older than where like Seinfeld and Friends, where they started. So they're at the end of like that wild bohemian thing. And they're slowly and painfully transitioning into settling down into a family state. But it's almost like mournful, like it's the death of youth, right? As opposed to like the start of something else. So they really struggle with having to give up that carefree childlike existence, open to serendipity in the big city, basically. And then fighting to grow up.
Was it set in the suburbs? That I can't remember.
No, it was set in Manhattan, I believe. But like,
I'm looking it up. It says Philadelphia. I swear.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I'm out here in LA. It all looks the same to me. I don't know. Yeah.
This is just a general East Coastness to it.
Yeah, there's brick buildings and they're narrow, and the people are neurotic but have money somehow.
I think critical mass hit after Seinfeld when like every Thursday show that left got replaced with another people in the big city show. First, it sucks in the city. That was one of them. That was HBO. But on
it was like late 90s, yeah, to into the 2000s.
Yeah, but
really, Sex and the City started in the late 90s.
98, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. It was in the 90s. Yeah, but there was Seinfeld. Then there was Mad About You, which is a married couple in the city. That's
right. There was Will and Grace.
Will and Grace.
Will and Grace, I don't think was on Thursdays though. But it fits into the motif. I'm thinking a specific Thursday. There's a Thursday takeover. Frasier? Frasier, I think, was there. There was Single Guy.
Friends. Yeah, Single Guy. You're right. Yeah.
Friends. Suddenly, yeah. Susan. They all rotated on Thursdays. Like, there was a fourth slot that would be things like Single Guy and Suddenly Susan. It was the fourth slot was just filler that was that people just watched because they sat through the first three. So it was like Seinfeld.
It was
Seinfeld, Friends, Mad About You, and then the fourth floater, which would be things like Single Guy, Suddenly Susan. I'm sure there's others that I'm forgetting, but they were all exactly what teen describes, and it was like the highest rated night in TV. And I had a friend that used to watch them. He used to drive me crazy because I used to call it like just the whining block, because it was just like 2 hours of people just whining.
Yeah.
Wait, then Trevor, like what age, what demographic were you in, like age wise in that era?
I'm Gen X, so I would have been in college during the Mad About You, Seinfeld era.
Oh, okay. I was still in like grade school, like not quite high school in the late 90s. So that era completely passed me by.
People underestimate like how much like life is genre. Like I don't know, just thinking back, like those. Not necessarily. I mean, Friends was extremely freaking influential in terms of like how people started joking and talking. Like everyone would do everyone sort of became Chandler in my mind. Right? Like,
oh yeah, yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
People's humor started to resemble like Chandler's. You know what I mean?
Sarcastic, kind of stunted.
Yeah, like people would do the Chandler Bing impression, but then. And then it would sort of fade into like it wasn't an impression anymore. It was just like that's how people joked.
Yeah, it did become like a whole personality type to be like Chandler. Like I remember, yeah. I used to I'd be reading comic books, and then like, you know, you read like a Spider-Man comic and he's talking like Chandler now. That just became a shorthand for humor.
That's an interesting observation, because that kind of like dry, kind of emotionally immature male archetype, that persisted very, very deep.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. Just it's interesting. I can recognize it, but I never really like could point the finger at where it started from. But Chandler Bing is kind of an interesting starting point for that.
I thought of an interesting thing that. I think it might be older than Chandler, but it had the same voice. And because you were younger at the time, maybe you were watching it, or maybe it was before your time. But in the old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon, Raphael was just like Chandler Bing too. the old 80s one. Do you remember that one where?
One. He's always like throwing a tantrum.
He's always saying something sarcastic. He just has a sarcastic aside. To everything that's happening. He's almost kind of commenting on it from like the outside. Hey, you know what's weird about those characters? Somebody pointed this out to me about how nobody reacts to them like they're making a joke. Like everyone's having a conversation and the person makes a very dry, funny comment on what's happening that the audience at home laughs about, but nobody in the narrative thinks of them as a funny person. Like nobody is actually acting like they're joking. Like nobody laughs in reaction to what they're saying. You know, they clearly just made a funny joke based on how everyone at home is laughing. You know, it's like they pause and maybe make a reaction shot in a smiling or whatever, and then just continue with the conversation. And it's because I don't think anybody in the
it's a little meta.
Yeah, it's a little meta.
I saw a write up about this, I think, on TV Tropes. Like, why is that, right? And it's purely a timing thing. They don't have time to write in a reaction to the thing because they're counting on the audience to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think what Tina's saying is right too. Where like he's it is kind of meta because like people don't really I feel like a lot of times it's meant to make fun of something happening in the writing, like. Almost like your friend in the room more than somebody is actually in their room.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's what I think it is. I think it's like it's kind of like remember like when Mystery Theater 2000 was it 3000 or whatever?
Yeah.
It was like you were sort of like watching TV with these two other characters or three characters, and they were just sort of like stand-in buddies for you. You actually looked at them from the back. It was weird, you know?
Yeah, I totally remember that.
Oh, I kind of like that whole, like, I don't know what that's called, like a genre of media or something where there's kind of like an intermediary between you and the actual thing you're watching.
Yeah.
Missed that, actually. Yeah, it was pretty popular in kids' shows. And occasionally it would crop up in like horror anthologies or something. But yeah, that's actually kind of an interesting mechanism. They should bring that back.
So Trevor, I think what I was trying to say in that tweet was, because I was just thinking about this, like, because I think this era is squarely behind us now, and I can kind of see it from like a kind of changed perspective. And what seemed like, I think the culture behind these sitcoms and the sort of like, it wasn't just sitcoms, it was movies too. And especially stuff that had to do with like relationships, like any cultural piece that had like any show or film that had a lot to do with like relationships and how people meet each other and form, you know, like romantic relationships.
You know something I'll throw in too.
I think
back then people thought of dating in the city as something that was going to be dreamy as hell. Like now, yeah. I think everyone thinks of dating in the big city as like hell on earth. They think of like social media, and they think of dating apps, and they think of going out and no one starts conversations with each other and whatever. But I think there used to be this idea that if I spend my 20s in the suburbs, I'm just going to marry my high school sweetheart and have a boring life.
Right.
I'm going to marry like the captain of the football team who's going to end up being a gas station attendant. And I'm going to have this very boring, stunted life. But if I go into the city for my 20s, you know, if I go away to college and I go to the city after college, I'm going to have these adventures in romance, you know, and even the misadventures will still be kind of fun, you know? And that feeling, I feel like it's totally gone. I think people are too cynical about dating. Social anxiety is like so normalized now. I think people don't really think about that. People are afraid to talk to strangers, or they get scared when strangers talk to them. It's a very much more neurotic generation in a way that I don't think shows like that work. I don't think a single guy or a Suddenly Susan or Sex in the City would really, or Seinfeld would really work the same. There's this weird bleakness to when they attempt those kind of shows now.
Yeah, it was weird, man. I was walking around with my wife in Manhattan like a couple weekends ago, and it just kind of hit me like, I don't know why. I was walking by Bryant Park at night, and it just hit me like, it feels like the mystique of New York City in the 90s, where everyone had a sort of like cultural aspiration. Not everyone, but like I think there was a national sort of like halo around life in Manhattan. And it was like borne out in TV and movies primarily, that is just gone now. Like there's a feeling to that era that I think has disappeared, and like the sort of Manhattan mystique just seems to have sort of withered on the vine.
Manhattan is Gotham City now.
Yeah, and also it's not even the center of New York anymore. Like I feel like Brooklyn is kind of taken over, and Brooklyn just doesn't look as cool as, because hipsters compared to like classic Friends, just doesn't look as cool. Like, you know, somebody's wearing a plaid shirt and has a scruffy beard and has a pot belly. It's just not as Brooklyn cool is not as cool as like I think old Manhattan cool, because there's this.
You mean it's not quite prime time the way that
old Manhattan cool is old money cool. That's the underlying theme. It's just the amount of like wealth and the associated cultural cachet that just followed along with money.
But I'm not 100% sure about that, because okay, in terms of money, I think it costs more adjusted for inflation to be a hipster in Brooklyn than it did to live in the village in the 90s. Like people
probably. But I'm talking about the cultural, because it's the story is like the Rube from Idaho or something, like small town, I don't know, Pennsylvania or something, and is all starry eyed and gets swept up into like some romance, and they're always like cultured in some way. There's always some implication that there's money around.
Yeah, I think it's money, but I think it's also like this aspiration to be cool, to be cultured, to get money. Even if you don't have it, you want to be in the orbit of it. You're aspiring to be successful at something
it's culture. So like you know which fork to use at dinner, and you know how to handle yourself at the Met.
But I think New York City sort of became like a generic city backdrop for a lot of these things. Like none of them are very New York in an inherent way. Like I would say.
Some what do you mean by others. Them? What does that them refer to? The movie, the sitcoms we're talking
the
about?
The 90s sitcoms? I feel like New York City sort of gets abstracted into like sort of any big city. And it's
no, I think it's very specifically Manhattan. It doesn't play the same if you set it in like LA would be like number two in that case. It just doesn't work the same.
Yeah, I also feel like they can't make it to New York because they want it to be accessible to like the Midwest. So it's kind of like a diet in New York, but it's still
It's
still New York. It's still
it's not like Woody Allen New York. You know what I mean? Like it's cut off from that sort of like very very like. Just I think what you're referring to was to me more alive in the 80s and 70s, but by the 90s, I feel like New York had become branded and abstracted out to the point where it was sort of like. It was very background, in my opinion.
I do think it's still New York. I do agree with Jess. Like compared to something like Home Improvement or something, it did still feel like Seinfeld. I think felt very New York, even though it technically was filmed in L.A.
Seinfeld had more New York roots. I would agree, yeah, but not in an old money way, in like sort of like a
Jewish way.
Jewish, like yeah, Queens way. Yeah,
yeah, it's very
little
rougher, Jewish.
A little more, yeah. But no, I don't know. Like, the promos all have some element that's like peak New York about it.
The logos often have skyline in them.
Yeah, with the World Trade Center like, or I like a steaming.
I think the Seattle of Frasier is really is as abstracted a version of Seattle as the Manhattan of Friends.
See, I was gonna mention Frasier because like the fact that it was set in Seattle seemed like kind of a little like. Insider joke almost that it's a that you know it kind of reflects that he's this like big fish in a little pond kind of it that running anxiety that he has this big ego but it really he's a big fish in a small pond, and that's the part that Seattle plays. Like he's not in Boston anymore, he's not in Manhattan. There's jokes constantly throughout that series about that, like he's just in Seattle. But he acts like a Manhattan bigwig or something. So I don't know. I think Manhattan itself just had this cachet to it. I don't know if it would coincided with some like peak Exodus.
No. I agree. I think it does have cachet. I'm just saying that what I'm trying to say is that there was I think that they were trying to like give a let people have a window into a certain kind of idea of urban life, and New York City and Manhattan are like the first that pops into mind in the US, because that's like the only real sort of really dense urban large area like city in of that nature. Though you could, I think some of them took place in other cities, but okay. So Trevor, what I'm trying to say is, there, like, if you pay attention, there really is this strong sense in the 90s. I'm not saying it didn't happen in other decades or in other times, but in the 90s, that there was this idea of, like, this sort of rootless person dropped into the big city, which is why I'm saying it's not really about New York. It's just about this big city, right, where there's sort of, like, an endless supply of, like, just random events. And random people coming in and out of your life and happenstance all the time. And life was really shaped by sort of stochastic processes. Like stochastic society in the sense that you didn't really have a fixed track. You just drop yourself into this sort of like random motion machine that was the big city. And then shit happened to you and people came in and out and whatever and jobs came in and out. But your life, in terms of finding love, meaning, success, friendship, whatever, including family, and it's like this ersatz family that you pick up along the way. Your everyone's neighbor was like became their best friend. Like there was no track, there was no path. It was this idealized sort of like large anonymous city where your life was just made up of these stochastic random events, and you need and. Not only that, but you had to be open to the idea that there was a sort of like weird plan within those events. Like you had to be open to the randomness of it all. And then there would be like this sort of breadcrumb trail where you would find your way to, you know, the right path for you.
However it's weird that it's at the end, there's still this faith in a higher power. Basically.
Yeah, sort of like the invisible hand, you know.
Yeah, the divine hand of fate that just says, like, if you fall in at the right moment in this completely random, basically abstracted physics experiment where you're a little ping pong ball, a massless, weightless ping pong ball shot in an airstream, basically. The divine hand of fate will guide you to your happily ever after. So it's still pretty religious. We just took, like, the social structure around the process to getting there, which is pretty nihilistic.
I just think it reflects a sort of faith in markets thing that was going on, where everything became a market, jobs became a market, society became marketized, and the ideal life was to sort of enter the biggest market that there was. And your like sort of inherent value would be sort of like your price would be discovered by the market.
I feel like New York is like in most people's mind the biggest market. I mean, the one thing I disagree with you is that New York doesn't matter. Where I don't feel that way. Like, I feel like New York is actually kind of a character it's an unofficial character in these things. Like what people like about it is they're going to Tom's Diner, and that's a real thing. If I visit New York, I could live in this neighborhood and have these kind of adventures. In Sex and the City, they would go to real nightclubs you can go to at the time. And that, like, I was old enough that I had gone to a lot of those places. Places like Chaos is in, like, the first season of Sex and the City. And it's, like, this place with this blood-red furniture, velvet that was covering the whole place. And, like, to me, when I watch, it's kind of like a time capsule. But when this is the idea, like, this is a place... This is one of the few places where this can happen. And you can go, you can live in the big building with a bunch of wacky neighbors. And you guys can go to Central Perk, which is this coffee house in the middle of Manhattan. And a bunch of interesting tourists and a stockbroker might come in, a bohemian woman, like everybody passes through this way station, this cross. Is that what they call it? Like a place where like a crossroads, everyone that's a kind of pastor. Like Casablanca could only happen in a place like Casablanca that is like a port. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like a junction. Like a, yeah, yeah, like a junction or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think like even in Boston is not quite good enough for that. Like it's like if you want that full experience of like, you know, I could see.
You mean in terms of scale or what? In terms of just like the size of it, or
the size and the density and the variety. Like if you were to have an episode where, I mean, ironically, even though these shows weren't very diverse, there was still a sense of the other in the mix. Like, you know, the Puerto Rican episode of Seinfeld, there might be an episode where I remember there was one where, and Friends, where there was this black coworker of Ross's and put this black woman there, and that's something to do with lunch in the fridge, someone's lunch getting stolen. Like, there was a sense like anything could kind of happen. Some immigrant guy who runs the local soup place and
just an aside, mm-hmm. I watched Seinfeld like 10 years after it like went off the air, but I knew about the soup Nazi. I was shocked to find out that this guy's in like one episode.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's it's a total aside, but
yeah, yeah. For the impact that
guy had, yeah. I think I can bridge the gap between what you're saying, Trevor, and what Teen's saying, because like New York absolutely is a character, but what Teen's like metaphor here, then New York is then a shorthand for like the randomest, biggest tank. This is where you're going to find the most.
Yeah.
If you want to trust the market, you want to put yourself in the one where like the most randomest shit will happen to you. And that's going to be Manhattan, because everyone's flooding there. All the coolest people, all the most ambitious people, everyone you could ever hope to have a shot at meeting will be there. So you better be there too, or you're going to be stuck having 5 kids with the gas station attendant from your little bumfuck nowhere.
Yeah, it's the main arena. It's the New York Stock Exchange of like life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like people around the world understand New York neighborhoods, so that helps too. Like, if it's to ask the average person, what is the Greenwich Village, the Bohemian area of Boston or Philadelphia, that person would likely have had to have lived there or been there or have some kind of idea, or the Upper West Side of Seattle. But I feel like New York, its regions are very universal from like decades of being on TV. So people who haven't ever been in New York, if a character is in Soho, they know what Soho means. You know, if a character is in this part, you know, Upper West Side, people have a general idea what that means. They can easily map it onto their city.
Actually, I actually don't know what Soho is or like where it is.
Oh, Soho, I think, I don't mean geography wise, but I mean, well, it's changing now because New York has become so homogenized with this monoculture of just this general metropolitan progressive hipster monoculture. So it's like, it's not as distinct as it used to be, but Soho was considered more like you might see models there and boutiques and high-end fashion. And it was kind of like the fancy part of town. Like in the 90s, it'd be where you expect to see, back when they were still at their peak, Cindy Crawford and Naomi Campbell. In the 80s
was when Soho was like where sort of like more like stylish yuppies would move and get a loft, and they would do like Ghost. Like they lived, I think, in a Soho loft, and you know, they were sort of like, she was artsy fartsy, he was an investment banker, you know, that kind of thing. Or
yeah, and I think a creative professional, like, you know, like
somebody, professional, yeah,
somebody who's professional, like they might work in an office, but they might work in like advertising, or they might work in fashion or something that's like bridging the gap between Bohemian. It's not as bohemian as the Greenwich Village or something, but it's not as suit and tie as, you know, like Midtown Manhattan or the stock exchange, you know.
So American Psycho, right? Where would that character have lived? Financial district or?
No, because back then you didn't really live in the financial district. You just worked there. So he would definitely work in the financial district probably. But I'm guessing he would have lived on the Upper East Side.
I think Pearson Pierce had a real address and it was definitely financial district.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But he would have lived in the Upper East Side.
Yeah, because I think probably, Upper East Side is where a lot of the original like 80s yuppies were. And there was a Upper East Side, I think, is where the yuppies were. I'm going to double check, but I'm pretty sure. I used to read a lot of Bret Easton Ellis books. And he used to use real Upper East Side like places for like where they hung out. It was a very popular bar.
For me to explain this is like, all right, if you look at compare what these sitcoms and how their relationship to New York versus something later like Sopranos, where I know it's more New Jersey obviously, but you're talking about like people who are like firmly rooted in, like, they grew up in that area, and when we're talking about specificity of location, it's like it has to do with maybe not the best example. I should think of something in New York itself, but actually Moonstruck was a good example of this. Like, it's very specific. You actually know the address of their house. It's on Cranberry Street in Brooklyn Heights. And it just has like a Brooklyn Italian family sort of vibe to it. Do you know what I'm talking about? And the references are all very local, and they're telling like a New York story, right? By someone who's been in New York their whole life. Whereas in the 90s, I feel like it's more, New York has become more abstracted, is what I mean.
And there's a lot
it's
more
transplants. The New York of like a transplant.
Yeah, there's a lot more transplants for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I can buy that because it was accessible to me. Like at that point, I'd never been to like Manhattan before. But it like the way it's laid out, it's like this is the kind of stuff you will see if you were to come here. Okay, I can see that argument.
Yeah, like none of the people read as like inherently like rooted in New York. You know what I mean? They're just sort of like trading in New York, if that makes sense. New York is a backdrop, and these people are just sort of like inhabiting it, but they're not really rooted in the place.
Is that true though? Because there's definitely like a lot of in jokes about people who are from there, so they're in the know, they're the cool kids, and then the rubes that are, you know, they don't actually go here. Like they make some kind of like rube mistake or something that shows that they don't actually belong.
I guess, but it just read it, by that point, it just read as really it to me felt a lot more alienated than the stuff that came before.
Okay, so we're talking. Okay, so like, where would you put that break then between that?
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's what I'm saying. The 90s. Something happened in the 90s, and I feel like it was this new. It was the. I'm trying to say that it was a reflection of a neoliberal era where they wanted us to get comfortable with the. They wanted people to get comfortable with the idea of being sort of living that kind of like atomized, somewhat dissociated life, like rather alone and sort of bouncing around from random event to random event in life.
There was this book called, I think it's called Urban Tribes. It was like very popular at the time. Let me see if that's the name. Okay. It's called, Urban Tribes. It was a very popular book. It was published in 2003. And it was kind of the subtitle of it was called Urban Tribes. And the subtitle was Our Friends, the New Family. And the description of the book says, in his early 30s, Ethan Waters began to realize that none of his friends were following the path of their parents. Instead of settling down in couples and starting families, they lived in vacation in groups, worked together at businesses they started, and met every other week for dinner. You know, so instead of like, you know, by your early 30s, having a family and you guys eat together every day and watch TV together every day and have a Leave It to Beaver existence, people in their 30s had these kind of surrogate families of, you know, I think that's when Friendsgivings became a really popular thing. I think it comes from this transplant culture that Teen's describing, where people are not staying in their hometowns, not settling down early. You know, you're forming surrogate families. So he started to document the phenomenon, and he started documenting tribes in cities.
When was this, by the way?
2003.
Okay.
In cities. Okay. I think that's when it kind of hit enough mass to warrant a book. But I feel like these sitcoms you're talking about were kind of part of that. I think the sitcoms not only documenting that trend, but inspiring it. I think a lot of people who grew up watching these sitcoms, especially if you're the kind of person that thought you were too cool, too hot, too smart for your rinky-dink town. You know, you always thought, when I grow up, I'm going to move to the big city. Like you know, the big city became the place where everyone who thought they were too cool for the people around them in high school, you know, felt like they were going to eventually end up in, be more understood, or, you know, find their level, you know. It was a book that examined that structure, and a lot of people kind of started reading it to, in the early 2000s, kind of try to understand themselves in their social life. But I feel like Urban Tribes describes this kind of situation that you're talking about, like that. Friends was an example of Urban Tribes, and Seinfeld, and a lot of these shows, you know, people making their, I think it's an interesting phenomenon.
There were LA versions too. Like, I think Swingers was a bit like that. Melrose Place was a bit like that.
That was a great one.
Yeah.
You know, I think ended up kind of replacing it, which I think is even more depressing commentary, was somebody pointed this out to me, but how the workplace drama started replacing that, where I think people spend so much time at work, you know, so it's like things like The Office was like the critical mass of that. But there were so many things that people's whole life was their job, to the point that even their off work stuff was mainly spent with their coworkers, you know?
Yeah, like was it 30 Rock and
Parks and Rec, and that,
like, NBC shifted hard towards workplace drama.
Was
that 2000, late 2000s, 2010s, that era?
That's when we're Parks and Rec. That's Office was late aughts, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, that was an adaptation of that, of the Ricky Gervais, the British version, which was
it
earlier.
Sort of took a life on its own, though. Like,
I agree. I think it was much more American.
Yeah. So let's see. American TV series based on the 2001-2003 BBC version.
But I think, like, one that's going on in the backdrop here in the 90s is, and here I do think New York City is very important, because a lot of the smaller, like, mid-market cities in the U.S. they're not very viable for a lot of people in the 90s. Like, all the jobs are shifting into the big cities. They're like, heartland cities are getting deindustrialized, and I think you start getting, it wasn't that at the time, like, I don't know if people knew exactly what that was going on, but, like, Trevor, I don't know if you recall, at least when I was in New York City in the aughts, like there were so many transplants, like, and everyone was from somewhere else. Everyone was pouring into the city. And and I think sort of this sort of alienated view of New York City more as a backdrop for random events rather than itself being a city where the people in it were, like, deeply rooted in the city, and the city was the people were the city. The city now just becomes a setting, and the people are sort of dropped in, and they don't live lives that have a lot of context, right? Like, they're not like the New Yorkers that you would see in, like, a Scorsese film or something, where they have, like, a history, they have, you know, a specific trajectory and path through life that they're, whether it's fucking crime or some shit or whatever it is that he's doing, but like
generational family ties.
Yeah, exactly. Like generational stuff. It's like,
or if it's brought up that the generational rootedness is a conflict that they are trying to actively extricate themselves from.
Yeah,
like half the humor in Seinfeld.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like half the humor in Seinfeld is like George fighting with his parents, Jerry like arguing with his parents, like being embarrassed and like pushing them away, basically.
Seinfeld is the one that I think is a little bit of a standout in that era, because I feel like unlike a Friends and all the other more minor sitcoms of the same type, like I feel like Larry David was uniquely aware of this. And so, you know how he said like no hugging, no learning? Like the one thing that Seinfeld...
No, I actually don't.
So that was the mantra. Like on set, they had a sign that said "No hugging, no learning," meaning like the show could never wander into like sort of like maudlin territory where any authentic emotion was betrayed. It was always okay, going
they can't
to
hug
be
it out.
Can't and hug it can't out. Learn you can't learn. Lesson. No one ever learns. Okay. And okay. You know, unlike Frasier, where like you know, or in Friends too, where like later. They like real romances started to butt up, and the show would track towards like a serious romance developing between some of the characters, which always marked the end of the show. Like that was it was over. Like once that was consummated, show was
yeah.
over.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Well, there's this old phrase. I don't know where it started or where I first heard it, but I feel like it rings true. Where they say, "Drama is about how we change, and comedy is about how we stay the same." Like there's a stuckness to comedy. It's almost like tragic comic, you know, in a way. Like at the end of each episode, Gilligan still on the island. Everyone's still in the Seinfeld building, et cetera. And then, like, the more change you introduce, the less it becomes a comedy. And I feel like Friends became, like, less funny when things started changing. I feel like that's always when the show is about to end. Like a comedy, you can tell as a series is coming to an end when things start changing, people start getting married, moving out, doing whatever. Like that's how comedies end. But like dramas end when things hit stasis. Like you know, like things stop being in flux so much. Like this couple ends up together for good. Achievement happens, and the guy becomes like the head of the company, and there's no more growth to do. Like that's when drama, like when the growth starts is like when comedies end, and like when the growth ends is when dramas end.
I think that makes sense. Do you feel though that like in the 90s into I would say the aughts, like comedy became a really dominant form of just like. So like not just of culture but like of actual life, like people felt, I'm just throwing, I don't know if this is true, but I kind of sense that people felt that life was a bit of a comedy.
I think, you know, what you're saying is not only true, I think it hasn't stopped. I think it has continued to grow and grow. Like the dominance of stand-up and comedy podcasts and comedy stands, I think is real. I mean, Joe Rogan and all the people who follow stand-up comedy drama, I think is very fascinating. Like, or just how things are expected to have so many jokes. Like, okay, look at something like, I was talking about this on another podcast, but there was a time, and I was saying that I feel like the movie Good Night and Good Luck, or Good Luck and Good Night, whatever order it goes in, was the end of this era. Was the era of like, liberals worship the serious journalists, you know, that Woodward and Bernstein, the whistleblower, the staunch Edward R. Murrow type and everything. And then at some point, they were considered like traitors. There were people, they were considered people who let, a modern journalist, people who let down their duty to people. And it was the comedians were going to save us. It was Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who were the ones who spoke truth to power, who were doing the job that reporters used to do, but don't anymore. Like they were the new Woodward and Bernstein. They were the new Edward R. Murrow, and that's continued to this day. Where we had this now was John Oliver or whatever, but this nonstop flow of who's going to be the next comedian to take on Trump? Who's our current Jon Stewart? Get comedy, I think, both as a genre, but as a way of life, has really because I remember I was talking to Chris about this. How I was saying when in the 2000s, everybody had a novel in the drawer, or Gina himself was writing like this next great American novel, particularly the urban novel. And now, like, everybody has a 15-minute stand-up set and is doing.
Yeah, that's kind of true. I've noticed that a lot of people have like stand-up aspirations.
Yeah, even if they want to be a stand-up comedian, they want to take up a stand-up workshop, know how to do a stand-up.
They
invite themselves out on TikTok and see what happens.
Yeah. Or take a stand-up class and then do an open mic, and they can work in an office during the day, but they just want to show, like, you know, it's like everyone wants to show that they had like a creative side by writing stories or fiction or whatever. And it used to be a popular thing to go to fiction readings, you know, in the city. And now there's just so much comedy. There's so many open mic nights, so many. And then it's become a way to break into everything. Like so many of like the worst POC writers all have stand-up comedy sets. Actors, if you want to get into acting, you get into it through comedy. If you want to be like a political pundit, you know, the best way to do it is to show that you can do stand-up. Like, even if you don't want to end up as a stand-up comic, it just seems like the best way to break into everything now.
It translates well to like short form social media.
Oh yeah,
Like cracking a joke. Yeah, so like it dovetails really nicely with in between like the push between like the space between like where technology and media, because everyone has the attention span of a goldfish now, and a laugh is cheap.
But the thing about that I find is sort of doomed to failure in a way is like I feel like a lot of people are doing this because they want to convey meaning. And essentially it's like comedy that, like you said, is sort of, it's the kind that I think a lot of people want to find meaning in it, and that destroys the comedy. Whereas I feel like the reason Seinfeld's, unlike a lot of other similar like works of its time, is specifically because it's aware of how this sort of like, this sort of completely detached, alienated lifestyle of the 90s, which is, by the way, is so weird. It's such a weird thing. I know I still feel like we're so connected to it that it doesn't, I'm not sure like everyone quite gets how weird it is. But
okay, maybe I can, because really I thought weird. It was super weird because I saw it like I started watching it at least like 10 years after it stopped airing. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that perpetually bothered me. Like, I know I could laugh with some of the jokes, but this, the way these people lived was so freaking weird.
It's so
to
bizarre.
Me.
And the it's only, really bizarre. I think the reason Seinfeld stood the test of time was because like it actually is aware of this, and they never found, you know, like the characters never found meaning. They never found that the one relationship. The show never matured, and they had to kill it off with like a literal indictment and conviction of them. And you know, it's interesting, like the show kind of progressed where characters kind of like cycled in and then out, and then they were like disposable. They came into the show for one episode, and then they were just like you said, like the soup Nazi guy, one episode, that's it, gone. And they would come in and out like this, and then the final episode, a lot of the characters from the past actually sort of reappear and then testify against the four of them.
I feel Seinfeld, because it's so secular, People don't really appreciate how Jewish it is, but I think it's a very, very Jewish show. And I would say that there's probably something very Jewish about this whole phenomenon that you're talking about. Like, I just went on Reddit to see if somebody, you know, I could find somebody that could explain it better than I did. So
we go to the people's source, yeah, Reddit.
Exactly. So I found this thing on Reddit just now while you were talking. It says, what does it mean when
you have such a gift for this.
I know.
They say, what does it mean when they say Seinfeld is Jewish humor, since religion and customs aren't a huge part of the show? I think Jewish people do this a lot. They put something very Jewish without making it explicitly Jewish so that it doesn't pigeonhole itself. So general population that adopts it as their own doesn't even think of it as Jewish. And like the popular examples I use are things like Mad Men or Superman. Like they're very Jewish things. Superman is like a immigrant assimilation story. And, you know, Clark Kent is like a, it's a struggle. It's a Jewish struggle of masculinity. Like, you know, like the Jewish guy who wants to be seen as Superman, but he's seen as Clark Kent. If you ever read a Jewish reading of Superman, it's very, very interesting. Mad Men is like, you know, Don Whitman is like the Jewish past. He's like an assimilated Jew, and he's worried about being. But
that's more like a de Tocqueville American Adam story.
But I think there's something extremely, because all the psychology in it, like psychoanalysis is very much the Jewish science. That's what they used to call it back in the day.
But how does that play into Seinfeld?
It's like Seinfeld is that type of. I'll first off, the way that they always talking about, what do you think about this? Isn't it weird that people do this? And is that's like very Borscht Belt. It's disguised because they put on a sophisticated level, but that's like very Borscht Belt kvetching. If you know what kvetching is.
Like, what's the deal with this? I also thought Seinfeld's stand up was the weakest part of the show. That part always annoyed me.
Oh, I love the stand up. I know people keep saying that, but I was a fan of his stand up before he started the show. Like, I always thought his stand up was very interesting. But you're not alone. Most people disagree with me on that, which I find interesting. But I think his stand up is very. But then his stand up
his stand up is actually really good. It's just those little the bumpers for Seinfeld, the show, that I could not stand.
Yeah, it's stand up. In general, it's a very Jewish art. I always have this theory that secular Jewishness is very hard for people to clock because it hides itself. Like, it presents, the Woody Allens of the world are like the hyper-real version of it. Like, they're extra Jewish to hide how Jewish everyday urban life is. You know, so people think of the Jewishness is located in the Woody Allens and the really foregrounded, over-the-top Jewishness. So it kind of hides how Jewish things like Seinfeld are. But these are some of the things that people say in the Reddit, too, when people ask them, what makes Seinfeld a Jewish show? And people say things like, Jerry's What the Deal bits are a textbook example of kvetching. Plus, both the writers are Jewish, so it'll be pretty difficult for them to not write Jewish humor. Then it says it's the neuroticism.
Wait, how are we on this topic?
Because he's describing this phenomenon, and I'm saying that I don't think you can really describe this aura that you're talking about without describing how Jewish it is. I think it's a very Jewish tradition. I think this will help clarify it. Someone says, I would argue that Jewish humor is steeped in a view that the world is a deeply hostile and unpleasant place, which makes sense since European Jews in big cities endured centuries of anti-Semitism and brought those sensibilities to the U.S. where they became prominent entertainment. Seinfeld has a very Jewish sense of humor in that it frequently depicts the inexplicable malice and hostility beneath the surface of everyday life. The characters often discover this when they violate some social norm. And Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, is even more Jewish in this response. So there's this sense in that there's this, it's hard for you to describe, but if you read enough of it, you'll see it.
I think I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, this kind of brimming.
Constantly running up, like, encountering hostility, friction with unspoken norms.
The weird thing, I think it's especially strange from our perspective as racial minorities, because from our perspective, they all kind of seem pretty white. But
I think Jewish people had to disguise themselves and their concerns as white to get traction because of anti-Semitism. So I totally agree. I think they're good at tricking WASP into thinking that there's some shows about themselves disguised as WASP shows that they think about themselves.
What I was going to say is that, like, I've noticed, like, I was at a friend's lake house, like, for the weekend, right? And this area of New Jersey is, like, super fucking white, and it goes back a long time. It's like this lakeside, this whole lake community, and so we go to visit my friend's father at the sort of, like, lakeside community center lodge thing that they got there, and, like, I'm with my friends who are, like, white Italian, and then one is, like, Nordic white, and then her husband, who's, like, very Jewish. His father is, like, a Jewish scholar, that kind of thing. And he goes to me at some point, and he was like, "Is this not the whitest fucking place you've ever seen in your life?" And I was just really surprised that this guy, you know, was feeling sort of, like, alienated from the whiteness all around him. And he made it a point to come to me to be like, "Don't you feel like this place is, like, super white?" Which was
you're
weird.
You're just standing there like, what the hell?
What's interesting was, like, I know what he's saying, but I guess it just didn't dawn on me to, it doesn't bother me because I'm like, yeah, of course this place is really white, you know? Whereas for him, I don't know if it had to do with, like, a half foot in, half foot out thing where it's like he do you know what I mean? Like, the fact that he kind of, like, more half belongs there because he's racially white, but he's a Jew. And so he knows that it's, you know,
yeah,
I don't know if that makes sense. Whereas I'm just like this Asian dude. I'm like, hey, I'm visiting white people for the weekend. This is fun. You know,
like, I am obviously outside the outside the circle here.
Yeah, and I'm not. You know, I'm just hanging out with my wife.
You know, I've had stories like that too, and I always interpreted that as kind of like a half bonding exercise.
Yeah, and
like I'm just kind of standing on the outside, and then they're like, hey, you know, I get it too. Like this shit's weird for me too. Let's hang.
Yeah, but they could also float in and out too. Like if they need to blend in, you know, a lot of times they can't to varying degrees. You know, like it's interesting that they. When there's like a true non-white around, I think it helps reinforce their whiteness in a way. But they can float in and out. It's very interesting. But like, take for example, like George Costanza. George Costanza's family is so Jewish. They're full of Jewish stereotypes. But technically, he's not Jewish. He's like presumed to be Italian or something. I think it's said his family's Christian. But if you look at the fact that he's based on Larry David, who's super Jewish, it makes sense that George Costanza.
Yeah. Isn't there like a lost like uncle or something in Italy who looks who's actually like, you know, played by Jerry Stiller? They're like Italian villagers or something.
Remember
that? I don't know.
There was an episode where
Jason Alexander
there's a,
Jewish himself? He looks pretty white.
I'm saying in the show, right. I don't think they're necessarily Jewish. He's necessarily Jewish in the show. They actually, I think, suggest they're Italian.
Let's see. I just clocked them as Jewish.
I think that's Trevor's point, right? Is that they're like sort of covert Jewish in the show, but they're like, they don't actually say they're Jewish.
Yeah, there was an article about about what they called crypto Jews, characters that are not really Jewish, but they kind of feel Jewish, and it's like
they had like Jerry Stiller plays dad. Whether George Costanza from Seinfeld is Jewish is a matter of debate. Okay,
there's an episode where Jerry Stiller plays like a brother, like a long lost brother to Frank Costanza, and he's like this Sicilian villager, like in Sicily, and he only speaks Italian.
And I feel like I've mentioned that his family is Christian, I believe. I could be wrong, but
Reddit to the rescue. George is supposed to be Italian American. His father's people are from Sicily, and his mother makes the comment once that she won't drive a German car. They keep it deliberately vague. He did sell Christian things in Korea, but they're of course Italian Jews. Okay.
Fascinated how we got into the topic of
Christian. And then comment number four is, guys, should we be talking about this? And that's kind of how I feel about this right now.
You're not comfortable with the crypto Jew talk?
Why are we here?
I'm not looking
at crypto Jew, by the way.
Because Trevor is about to chime in with a very interesting thought, but do you think this is a good place to cut it and then we'll move to like a bonus portion? What do you think? I don't know what the timing is like, but
why not? But people might want to cross over to hear.
We can't end on talking about crypto Jews. We can't do that.
All right. So if you want access to the crypto Jew part of this episode,
we explain ourselves fully.
I owe no explanation, but we'll continue this on the bonus pod, which will be on the Patreon feed. And if you want access, go to patreon.com/PlannyMag. We'll be right back.